This one is on mixins and traits as opposed to the multiple inheritance talk last time. So the basic question for this lecture is what modularization techniques are there besides multiple implementation inheritance? So the solution that we have seen last time and or the last two times. So what we're going to tackle today is a few design problems that we face when we have to model our software with inheritance, multiple inheritance, and what particularly bothers us or motivates us to switch to different alternatives. Then we will see or look at how inheritance internally works a little bit more in detail, this time under maybe different aspects. So this is what we're going to see in this one here, where we will work on a model for single inheritance. And the set up a structure in which to set up expressions on inheritance relations. And with this, we then model the so-called mixins that we then see live in, well, first of all, as a programming pattern in some standard language, and then natively implemented in some other language. The second focus of this thing will be on traits, where we further look at a few things or aspects that the implementation inheritance gives us that seems not so flexible. So we look at how to come up with a solution to that. And once again, we go back to inheritance calculus and have a look at what we can do differently by separation of composition and modeling in this case. So this is the focus on traits. And then we have a look at how traits are found in the wildlife out there in terms of concrete languages. So let's dive right in. So far in the lecture, we have seen that for the mantra for providing reusable software, so far inheritance was the thing that we have looked at. And well, if you look at existing software systems, sharing of code and reusage of code is often tried to be established by use of implementation inheritance. There are several flavors out there, which we have seen last time, like single inheritance and multiple inheritance. And basically, they all somehow tackle problems of decomposition and composition. Let's maybe look a little bit more into concrete problems that we might find when we try to apply the principles of this inheritance. So, for example, let's imagine being a game developer, having to develop an adventure game with several rooms connected with doors. And, well, in these systems, you might imagine that doors might be some kind of an obstacle, in the sense that they might be either locked or a short door. And, well, the first maybe naive approach to that would be to implement a door as some kind of class and then create a subtype of that, being a very short door as one kind of obstacle, then a locked door. And at some later point, you come to the idea that you maybe want to have something like a short locked door, both of these properties in the same class. And if you try to fit that into the modeling that you have done so far, you might wonder, how do I connect this new short locked door to the ones that I have so far? Well, you would have to either already at that point resort to something like multiple inheritance by inheriting from both of them. That would maybe solve the whole thing. With single inheritance, what would you do at that point?
Well,
no idea, just give up. Yeah. Well, with interfaces you get the solution to being able to inherit from several of them. However, the question is whether that really helps, because you would actually be somehow interested into the actual implementation that is provided by these things. So nowadays, interfaces are not so strictly without any code anymore. So your answer might be at some point the right one, but one alternative at least. But for now, let's maybe skip that a little bit. So aggregation as the alternative to inheritance. Well, that is the big other principle in there. You can have references to other things, and you might want to work around the whole thing, like in a way that you have your basic door that, for example, manages a list of door-like elements, like a short module that can be kept in this list, and a locked module that can be kept in this list, and that would iterate through this list of modules every time that something like the can open or the can pass is called, and then evaluate each of the things that it keeps in its list of modules until it runs out of implementations. For example, that's one way of doing that. You could also think of a way of, well, like trying to give it as a parameter and somehow to a linked list. I don't know. There's several ways of doing that. But the principal idea would be to instead resort to aggregation instead of just inheritance. This has certain drawbacks, of course. There's you need to somehow have an insight into you need an infrastructure for having this chaining of modules, for example. Also, you need to have insights into the aspects that you want to wrap together later on, like the can pass and the can open, that both can be somewhat modularized or parameterized, and you need to offer them in this interface in that sense in order to be able to call them in your chain of modules. So, all in all, what you in this scenario lose, of course, is this notion of specialization that you had beforehand, where you had this short door being a special door, the locked door being a special door, and the short locked door being a special door. You can kind of try to later on introduce classes that statically initialize these lists in ways that that are desirable, and then have something restored like inheritance relation, but that all that is somewhat artificial, maybe. Another problem from the from out there, you might, if you have contact to systems like Java, you might be familiar with this infamous stream hierarchy that is out there, where you have certain streams that build up from each other and at some point branch off, and then you get things like file stream and socket stream as different branches of your inheritance relation. And at some point, for example, you might wonder that later on in your life you think about parallelization of your software, and you think about, well, wouldn't it be nice to have another module that provides all the synchronization aspects of your architecture, and you would somehow want to fit it into your stream hierarchy as kind of wrappers around the file stream or the socket stream or potentially any stream. That is a thing that now is a little bit, well, unclear what to do at that point. So far, you cannot really use things like multiple inheritance here, because inheriting from file stream and socket stream somehow isn't the right relation between the synchronization facility and the socket stream. That doesn't really fit into our system. Idea. So how can I do that in a modularized way? Well, you can, for example, do something like this, where you introduce the sync RV as with an aggregation. You have some stream object as a member of your sync RV thing. And then you basically kind of need to somehow reproduce the methods that you wanted to outfit with your synchronization code. And with that, you can then plug in something like a file stream or a socket stream in there, and your synchronization stream could somehow then make use of that. However, this undoes the specialization aspect that in principle could be seen as a meaningful thing. And also this needs for all the things where you want to put the sync RV thing into, of course, having a common ancestor somewhere. So, well, that is one of the solutions that you see out there. Then you could think of multiple inheritance being used in a way like this one, where you have the file stream and the synchronization module on kind of the same level and inheriting from both of them, which still needs some kind of glue code in your child class, like the synchronized file stream, where the read and the write needs to call the acquire lock and release lock, of course. However, it seems that for the synchronized socket stream, you need to provide actually exactly the same thing, like read and write being outfitted with calls to acquire and release. And it's debatable whether that is actually the way that you would like to have your software, since that is, again, replication of code in that sense. And whether that saves you so much is really the question. So that is a cause for duplication in that sense. You could also argue with, well, since we have a hierarchy that at some point has a common ancestor, why not move the functionality back to that point? So the sync RV functionality somewhere in the common ancestors, and then having the synced file stream and the synced socket stream just make use of the acquire and the release lock. However, this somehow messes with your idea of when to actually introduce the synchronization into your hierarchy, in the sense that it comes very early on in the inheritance hierarchy. However, it's only introduced at a very late point in the hierarchy. So you might wonder whether that is actually a problem, but from a point of view of keeping your designs clean, that might be not so much what you want. So all in all, these are problems of distributing functionality and functionality providers throughout the hierarchy that you implement in there. That is what this functionality and composition is meant to be about. So in order to gain insight, to examine what we actually mean when we talk about these inheritance things, let's go back to kind of the theoretical foundations for that again. So what is it when we talk about classes and methods in principle? So for our purposes, we look at classes and their methods in terms of mathematical constructs. For example, well, functions, which we call maps in our cases, since we have just finite mappings in there. So we consider classes to be maps from names to elements of, well, either method bodies, which is implementations for our for our purposes, or references to other classes, or some escape symbol bottom for signifying that this name is kept abstract, or this top symbol signifying that this name has several alternatives to be dispatched to and is considered to be in conflict. With that, we have flat lattice that the values to which we map to, So, in general, such functions from names to these flat lattices we call classes, and particularly interfaces are classes where each of the mappings are abstract. Abstract classes are classes where at least one value is abstract, and concrete classes are classes for which all values are neither abstract nor in conflict. With that, we can have a look at how we compose classes with each other. So it's now about expressions between classes. And so we have two operands, the first and the second, and in between we might have several operators. And what we can think of is, for example, the so-called symmetric join, which is defined component-wise. So if we look at the maps C1 and C2 and look up a name N in both, then this is the least upper bound between B1 and B2, where B1 and B2 are the values of the mapping of C1 and C2 with respect to N. And since that might not be a thing that everyone is really used to, I have this case distinction that tells you what this actually means. So this evaluates to B2 in case that B1 is so far abstract or not present as a concrete value, or if the name isn't even a member of the pre-image of class 1. And same goes for the other case, where the value for C2 is abstract, then of course we the whole thing evaluates to the value from mapping C1. If both of the mappings agree on the actual value which to provide for a name, then, well, it doesn't matter which one I take here. Here it's B2, but it could be it's the same anyway, so it doesn't matter. And if both of them have a mapping which differs from each other, then, well, we consider them to be in conflict. That would be one way of performing joins. That is maybe the one that comes to mind when you think about composing maps at first. However, this is not the one that you find in use for performing inheritance. In inheritance, you have the so-called asymmetric join, which is, again, defined component-wise. So if I join asymmetrically, C1 and C2, then if I have an entry for my name in C1, then this is the one that is valid for the composition, and only if there is no value mapping for this name in C1, then we take the version from C2. So this gives C1 priority over C2, and as kind of a visualization of that, I've put this little arrow into the operator to tell you it's C1 has priority over C2. So yeah, that is the asymmetric join, and that is actually the core element of inheritance. So as an example here, we have a look at this so-called small talk inheritance, which is, this is just the basic standard inheritance that you know from maybe a lot of the other languages out there, because it's just small talk who has been kind of the initial language that popularized the this notion of inheritance. So that's why it's called small talk inheritance, but it's basically the same thing that you still have nowadays in languages like Java or C#. So the idea is that it's an asymmetric join. The children's methods dominate the parents' methods. So with that, you need to have an explicit way to refer to your parent at some point in order to actually access the former or your parent's version of the same method. And that is what the small talk inheritance operator gives you. So this is a binary operator from that takes two classes and creates a new class, and it's defined with the help of this asymmetric join, in the sense that basically it asymmetrically joins C1 and C2 with priority to C1 and adds a super name into the whole thing, which maps to C2, which is your reference to the parent. So that is the way that you would model this inheritance thing. And you can have examples for that, like in our case over here, where we have a door, which is, well, it has, this is a mapping that maps two names to bottom, so it's, in that sense, an interface. And you can then construct the locked door as with the help of the inheritance operator with the expression over here. We have door as your base class, and another class which is, well, not named in that sense. It's kind of anonymous in that sense, and is seen to be the increment that is added to the door in order to create the locked door. That's the usual way that you specify classes in programming languages, and they are connected with the small talk inheritance operator. And well, you can then just inline everything, which gives you a clause over here, and then you just have to apply the asymmetric join in that sense, which will override the can open mapping, not mapping to bottom anymore, but instead mapping to some concrete address, and leaving the can pass the can pass mapping still abstract, but introducing a super reference to the door, which gives you access to your parents' methods. So in principle, that is the way that you can model these things. I have had a hard time looking at alternatives to that in terms of concrete languages that have different ways of handling inheritance. Back in the days when this kind of standard inheritance was not yet established, there were actually different approaches, and there was one that actually has made it in some language, which is called Beta. Clearly, everyone programs Beta now, so this seems to be some mainstream thing. But just to show you that there's other ideas of how to use or how to implement inheritance. In Beta, well, Beta is a language that comes from the area of security critical systems. So there's the basic notion that the programmer wants to very strictly control whatever can be done with his software, even later on in stages where you do some these incremental changes to the software by introducing new modules. So the idea was to restrict the points in the software that you could actually where you could actually replace implementations with new ones, and to explicitly allow that the inheritance expressions were with different semantics in that sense. And for that purpose, the methods of the parents would always dominate the methods of the children, in order to make sure that everything still remains working as it was intended, and to explicitly delegate control to the subclass only via a particular keyword, and that is this inner keyword. In that sense, the Beta inheritance can be seen also as a binary operator on two classes, child and parent, and would create a new class out of that. But in contrast to before, parent parent and child would actually swap places as compared to what they would have before, and the inner keyword would refer to the child instead of the parent, so the first operand instead of the second operand. And with that, you get a different binary operator, and, well, to somehow graphically show that this is the other way around, I've switched the triangle around. And unluckily, the syntax is somewhat exotic for our eyes, so I have tried to somehow translate that into some Java-esque, C-esque syntax, but it's actually quite different from what this over here. So this is pure fantasy, but is intended to show you how this was intended to be used. So you could, for example, implement your base class, your parent class, like this person thing, which would have an attribute and a method, which would return the attribute from before, and explicitly offer a call over here that would explicitly enable overriding of methods. And you would do that by explicitly referring to that. And in case that there actually is, in case that there would be some kind of subclass that would provide an appropriate method, then, for example, this graduate, which is an extension to the person, which would add a suffix to the whole thing, well, this would be referred from over here. So, yeah, that is one way of maybe doing that. But, yeah. Well, yeah, that's why this Java C syntax doesn't really fit the whole bill. It would somehow need to specify that would be then empty. It's it's not a real concept that you see over here. It's just to somehow show you how it could be. But there need to be principles for what happens if there is no no overridden version. Yeah. But that would be the way to go for in that sense. So, what can we do with that that helps us in our problems that we've seen before? So, if we fantasize, what we would really like to do is we would somehow, in our case of short locked off, we would simply just cut out the pieces that we need from other places and put them into our new place, and like to do so without really doing too much fuzz like glue code or anything. So how could we do that? Well, we could think of systems that would just specify to do exactly that, to keep a module locked around and a module short around, which provides us with functionality, which we can compose in an arbitrary way and then mix into the hierarchy that we introduce with this step. And this is already giving you the name of the actual concept that this is all about. This is the so-called mix-in. The idea is to introduce one inheritance step that is used to mix in content from other modules that are, in that context, also called mix-ins. So it's a this word has two meanings. There's the verb performing the action of one step in the inheritance. That is a mix-in step, and the module that can be mixed into is also called a mix-in in that sense. So that's two places where we use this word. If we could fantasize about a syntax for that, you could, for example, think of it like that way, where you have this keyword mixin with which you introduce these mixin modules that provide functionality like this can open in our door example, and can refer to the implementation of the superclass at some point in order to default to that if there's the need to. And in the same way, you could have the same thing for short, and then you could start composing by mixing these mixins into your class hierarchy. So, for example, you could create a short door by mixing in the short mixin to the door. Same way to the locked, to create a locked door, you mix in locked. Then you could create a new mix-in that is composed of the content from short and locked, and create a short locked door either by mixing in twice or mixing into the composite thing. So this would be the kind of the idea of how to handle this this thing. How can we realize that? In order to provide some functionality like this, what we actually are after is extending the expression types that we can use when we compose types in our software. So what mixins are, they are constructors that take a class and create a new operator that can be used in type expressions. And in that sense, they can be considered to be unary second-order type expressions. What that means is that with this mixing constructor, this what we do is we take we have this mixing constructor usually take one parameter of type class, and what that creates is a function that maps a class to another class. And concretely, what is implemented in this mixing constructor is that the class that you get as a parameter is taken as the new child class in an inheritance expression, while the parent class is still left open. So this is a lambda expression. That means that this x is not bound at definition time of this function. So this is still open. Thus, we get an object that takes a class as a parameter, which is then fed into this x, and will end up being the new base class for a thing. So what that creates us is some kind of unfinished inheritance clause that can be passed around and used throughout the type expressions in our inheritance definitions. Let's have an example. Let's assemble a few mappings with which we can work the lock that gives an implementation for can open, short that gives an implementation for can pass, and we can then compose locked and short into short locked or locked short by composing the mixin that we get from short and mixin that we get from locked. And this would lead to the expression over here, where we would have a free variable that still needs to be bound, which ends up being the base class of both of short and locked. And in the end, the class that is created by applying this operator to another class would be a class that inherits from this new parameter and then has locked as the first subclass and then short as the second subclass of that. And so this can then be applied to some other class in that sense. So with that, we can, for example, also realize the other problem that we have identified, the one with the streams that would at some point branch into different stream branches. And we can now put the same module that provides the synchronizing facilities into the hierarchy by mixing in this synchronized facility into the inheritance hierarchy after the file stream as well as the socket stream, and end up with new synced file stream and synced socket stream classes that both carry the same functionality. And since everything that this mixin creates is just so far unfinished inheritance step, this just works as if you would directly put this synchronized facility in there and duplicate it in some sense. So without actually doing duplication on your source code level, this still puts the synchronization facility between both of these steps. And I'm not so particularly happy about the diagram over here, because it lets it seem as if the read and write would have to be provided in these things. Actually, they can be done over here. So there's no necessity to re-implement them in that way, because you can just put them in the mix-in itself and just mix it into the hierarchy and have these implementation override the ones from the parent. Yes? The multiple inheritance would not allow for the mixin to actually somehow refer to its brethren over there. So, in order to override things like read and write. With multiple inheritance, you have a hard time of actually referring from here to these implementations over there. So you could, that's why I'm so unhappy with having read and write at the bottom over here. That creates a false impression. So the actual benefit is to have the read and write once over here, at that position, overriding the versions from above, and being able to override this one as well as this one. And that is a thing that you can't do that easily in the multiple inheritance version. Well, it's just you don't have this ability of defining open inheritance clauses with multiple inheritance. It's just a different thing. Yeah, that's right. It's in that sense not so. It doesn't fit into the system as well as an actual subclass would, but it's still. Yeah, it has similarities in the sense that the way that it overrides things, but it's not explicitly accessible as being a subclass anymore. In terms of implementations, what you would actually need to change when you have a mixin step in your inheritance is that, well, since these mixins can be created arbitrarily in your code and depend on the control flow, you can't statically create any hierarchies anymore. So for the steps of performing compositions and mixins, what you have to do now is you have to create dynamical superclass references, for example. So you can't statically look them up anymore. You can't carry them in your object file, for example, in C++ in a pre-computed way anymore. You have to dynamically create them. This also means that you can't have pre-computed virtual tables for everything anymore, but you need to dynamically patch virtual tables, thus maybe create virtual tables in the writable space of your code. So it changes around a lot of things if you would want to fit that into language like C++ on this kind of native level. This is kind of connecting to the questions that you had. Is that something different from multiple inheritance? And it actually is. So multiple inheritance alone is not enough, but still, C++ gives you means to do things similar to mixins, and that is through the use of templates. So the idea of introducing something like mixins into a C++ program would be to, well, what you actually need is some way of specifying that you can plug an inheritance expression into onto some base class that is yet not statically defined. So what you do is you keep that as a type parameter. So you introduce your superclass as a type parameter and put that as the superclass of your thing, and then you can specify your read and write methods, for example. So you see it's the read and write methods are actually meant to be in the mixin and not in the resulting class. So yeah, they are actually here, and they refer to the acquire lock and the release lock from the synchronization module, and refer to the read version from the superclass without actually having a concrete superclass yet. You can also do a similar thing with adding logging functionality to some other class. That is in this thing over here. And in the end, then create classes that make use of your mixins. And the way that is, just say it, you apply the template onto some basic thing, like here it's used to be a larger example than the one that you see right now, so there have been some changes. Maybe I should revert that. In principle, you would want to do this sync RV on the stream, for example, so you could just instantiate your template with your network stream or your file stream, and then have a new class that has the functionality from your particular stream implementation and the synchronization code added, without actually really having to duplicate the actual synchronization code from your synchronization module. So that is how you can add that to something like C++. But you see, for that, not multiple inheritance was the problem, but being actually able to specify that the superclass is unbound at time of definition and only bound at time of instantiation, or well, not instantiation, but at time of creating a new class. So that is the core thing to remember about this mixing concept. So to sum it up, because you've seen the C++ realization now as well, with templates you can just see things like mixins as some pattern of how to write code in a specific way, but you needed a functionality in your language that lets you do things like keep the parent class parameterizable in order to do that. What true mixins, or what the initial idea when mixins were published first was that you would natively support the super thing, not kind of have it as a template variable, but as a native keyword of your language, and to have it really modular, having a concrete representation of mixin in your language, because in the way that it is realized in C++, this goes into templates, which means that there's not an actual representative of the mixin on object level, but instead the code is duplicated when the actual object is generated every time that it is used, and in that sense there's a few consequences that to bear. The mixins have to be declared as templates, which has certain drawbacks in the sense of, well, keeping your sources closed away for other people's. But anyway, in TrueMix sense, you would have some kind of alternative to multiple inheritance, which lets you kind of transport functionality at several places when you need that. Is there languages with native mixins? Well, there actually is, and well, it has been sometime. I don't know how popular a thing like Ruby is nowadays. Is there anyone who programs in Ruby? Yeah, I've had classes where half the people would raise their hands. So it seems that nowadays. Popularity, yeah. Well, but anyway, I hope that it's still well. People still know Ruby in that sense, that at least to the word. Yeah. So, well, in Ruby you can have things like mixins. They are called modules in there, and that is a thing that you will encounter throughout several topics that we have. That the names that are used for things in the context of one programming language completely change when you read them in another programming language. So I usually try to look for the publication that comes first, and then try to use the term according to the first publication of that, but that might be in conflict to the way that some languages implement these features. So there might be conflicts in there. So anyway, it's called a module in Ruby, and you define it in a way like this, where it's our old example of doors and a module short that overrides the can pass in a certain way that only small people can pass. And then there's the module for locked over there, and then some way of actually somehow connecting these modules to the classes that you have defined before. So there's the class door that defines can open and can pass, and the way that you connect them to each other is, well, this is this action of mixing in is seen over here, where we see that the short locked door is a subclass of door, while we mix in the modules short and locked. So that is one way of doing that. Another way that is offered via this language is kind of the more dynamic approach. You can dynamically mix modules into your classes by that's not on this one over here, that's I think on this one over here. So there you see some alternative things. There's still the door provided over here, and the two mixins for short and locked, and then there's the composition of two mix-ins. So the module short-locked consists of short and locked mix-ins. And here you see the dynamic version of mixing in. So this is a valid instruction in your program code, can be triggered depending on where the control flow of your program goes. And whenever control flow hits your this instruction, then whatever object hides behind D is extended by the mixin that you or module that you find over here. So you can dynamically add mixins to already existing objects. So yeah, that's that. With the thing that we have seen so far, we could argue whether the inheritance as we have seen it so far is already the ultimate, what we can achieve in modularizing software and creating reusable code. And you see a few points where there's criticism on the way that these systems work. One point is, for example, the so-called lack of control. For example, this one over here, where the where it says the common base classes are shared or duplicated at class level. So the granularity with which you can determine whether you share or duplicate classes are always with classes as a whole in that sense. So the mountable, well, in this example over here, you see that there's, we're building drones now. There's the basic module, which is a mountable plane that has fuel and equipment. And you can imagine trying to survey people with a camera plane that has a camera that can shoot, and you can download the pics from there. And you can also think of the military chipping in and trying to have a combat plane that can also shoot with its equipment, but might also want to reload at some point. And you could imagine that the police wants to have both. It wants to do surveillance and wants to shoot around. So this police drone might be a camera plane as well as a combat plane. And you might now wonder, what does it mean when I say that sharing and or duplication is decided at class level? Why is that a bad thing? Well, in this mountable plane, for example, you have the fuel tank, which well, would be silly to duplicate whenever you introduce such a composed drone that uses two already existing drones. Duplicating the fuel tank is just, well, not necessary. However, if you join the equipment, it's unclear whether your system, whenever you trigger the shoot on the equipment, just takes a photo of your suspect or already eliminates it. So if you only have the granularity of talking about the complete class in that sense, you limit yourself at a certain degree. This is reflected also in this conflict of, between super as an ancestor versus qualified specification. So on all, you don't have any fine-grained specification whether you want to duplicate or share elements of your system. The other thing is that with inheritance, you can run into situations where the hierarchies that you build up are actually not reflecting appropriate properties of your reality. For example, imagine a system where there's the linked list class, and then there's the stack, which is a special linked list class that also offers interfaces like a push and a pop and push many and whatever else. However, this might turn a few methods that the linked list has been able to provide in the past obsolete in a certain sense, particularly the add at a particular position in your linked list might be not desirable to expose within your stack, particularly since people tend to not read documentations and just try out whatever their syntax completion gives them. And when there is a function of a certain that creates a certain impression that you could call such a thing, then someone will actually call it at some point. One of the basic concepts of these hierarchical object-oriented systems, however, is that you need to keep to the list of substitution principle, so that everything that was offered in terms of syntax from your base class needs also be fulfilled on your child class or subclass. So you can't really hide away things that you have specified at one point. this makes you wonder whether implementation inheritance is actually really a good idea to have. And there's even prominent examples where people who should really know better have certain flaws in their libraries. So this is an excerpt from the Java 8 API, which has exactly such an example as we have seen before, where there's a hierarchy built up, and at a certain point, older methods still turn up in your completion. However, in terms of semantics, it's not desirable to have access to those anymore. And yeah, this happens to the experienced of us, it seems. So, this makes, or at least this made a few people think about alternatives to the way that software is composed, and this led to the idea of so-called traits. So what is it about traits? People have thought about, heard about designing software and composing modules, and have come to the conclusion that a lot of the problems that are out there in practice originate from the tight coupling between implementation and, well, provision of implementations and the actual modeling of the interfaces. And it seems that the interfaces often seem to be hierarchical or hierarchical enough. However, functionality is better, or often better, kept separate from each other in separate modules. So the central idea behind traits was to separate the creation of an object from the modeling of the interface hierarchies and the composition of the functionality fulfilling the demands of the interface definition. So what is used in traits is that interfaces design hierarchical signature propagations, and traits are used as modules for assembling functionality. In that sense, the traits are the library objects in these systems that carry implementations of functions, while everything else is just interfaces. And in the end, when everything is all the hierarchies are modeled and the functionality is provided at some point, you join them together to create an actual class, and classes are kind of the outside interfaces to the functionality in the traits, and the signature hierarchies that are done in the interfaces. And for that, what is proposed in traits is to have another operator on types, the so-called trait sum, and this is a binary operator on traits, creating new traits. So that's what you get over here. So this trait sum works on two traits as a parameter and gives a new trait, and it is defined again component-wise as the component-wise least upper bound. So that is the operator that we have seen earlier on, which came to our mind, that doesn't really prioritize one of the operands in the join, but instead joins if both of the operands agree on their mapping, or if only one of the mappings has information about a certain name to look up. And if there is an actual conflict, then the value remains in conflict until there is something done about that. So that is the trait sum, but that is not all that is used in trait modeling. There's also the ways of resolving the conflict that will be there at some point, and this is done with other expressions on types. There's particularly the so-called exclusion, which works on a trait and a name and creates a new trait. And what it does is it removes a mapping from a trait. So if the name to be looked up matches the name that is excluded from this trait, then it returns undefined. And in every other case, the mapping remains the same. So this is exclusion. And then there's aliasing. So this is this operator over here. And this works on... So it's a ternary operator. It works on a trait and two names and gives a new trait. So what it does is it... you specify a trait and... A goes to B, and what that does is, in case that you look up B, you look up A, then you return the value from B, and in every other case you return whatever you have returned before with that thing. So this maps the entry that is stored for A to the value of the entry that is stored for B. So with that, you have three new expressions that you can modify your mappings with, and those are the ones that come into play for traits. Finally, when you have done your assembly of functionality, what you usually then do is you create a class in the end in order to connect your functionality libraries to the outside by, once again, an asymmetric join. So you usually take a trait and add it to some class. So this is kind of usually meant to be the last step in composing functionality. Why do I still need these classes in the whole picture? Well, this is because traits are usually defined without having attributes. So this seems a little bit restrictive in the beginning, but without having actual state, it is much easier not having state, you actually defer the decision to separate or to join representations until the point at the end where you create the actual class representation, and there you need to decide whether or how you deal with accesses to state. And what you usually do in these systems is that in these traits you define abstract getters and setters that are never actually implemented in the traits themselves, but as soon as you asymmetrically join with a class, you connect all these abstract getters and setters with concrete implementations in your class, and they override the so far abstract getters and setters, and there you have the actual control over whether you want to share attributes or whether you keep them separate, and you do that in the very last step. So all what you get with that is you have a quite flat ordering of your modules. All traits have the same precedence. On the trait sum, there's no overriding happening during the functional composition. And as soon as you run into conflicts, you have to explicitly disambiguate your implementations via aliasing and exclusion. The asymmetric join then in the end can be used to definitely override things on the class level, so the classes still have precedence over the traits, and this is a necessary thing in order to create a state in these trait systems. And in the end, you cannot disambiguate whatever you get from other classes anymore, so there's a kind of flattening happening in there. If you have conflicts in your trait compositions, we have already said what you can do is you can alias or exclude as you want, and there's still the possibility of overriding in the final class whatever you want to achieve there. So in the same way as we have seen before from mixins with C++, the question is, can we augment classical languages with systems like traits? And what might come to mind are the so-called extension methods. You might know them from C#. I don't know. Is there any active C# programmers in here? One? There also have been more in the past. So what the central idea of that is to uncouple definitions of methods from concrete class bodies to a certain degree, at least. So the idea was to retrospectively add methods to complex types, like some kind of external definition. And what this particularly does is that it enables you to provide definitions for methods for interfaces. So it's with that, as you know, in C# you can implement several interfaces. This is some kind of steps into the direction of multiple inheritance in that sense. What you need to do for that is you need to declare a static class with the definitions of the methods that you want to add to interfaces as static methods, and explicitly flag the first parameter of your static method with the modifier word this. And this will make the first parameter act as a receiver in this Smalltalk speak would be. And then import the carrier class. This is the one which is the type for the this flagged parameter into the scope. And then you can call the extension method as if it would be an actual member function of your receiver type, with the exposed syntax that we have seen earlier on, which is this infix form. So, as an example, we have again persons and this short and locked door exams. I know it's always the same, but this shall keep you from having to parse into new context each time that I do this thing. So, we have a static class which acts as a carrier for the extension methods, and you have static methods, can open and can pass, that have these the first parameters flagged with the modifier this, and the type of this parameter is in this case locked and short. And so there's interfaces locked and short. So what this means is that this is an extension method that will attach to this one to short and the other one to locked. So this goes to locked and this goes to short. So later on, you can, for example, use this short locked door, which implements locked and short. And locked and short are both interfaces that are empty. There's nothing in there, so you might wonder what is the point. Well, there is this extension methods later on that you can then call transparently on these things. Like you can create this short locked door as a new short locked door, and then call this can open on set D in the usual infix notation, with the short locked door being pulled out from the parameter list in front of the method call. So that is what... yeah?
So the extension of methods can access the store class of the short code in this case.
Yeah. So what this offers is, well, you can extend arbitrary types without having real write access to these type definitions. So then... external fashion in that sense, and well, if you have always missed a particular method from some library function, this is a quick relief for you. But it's not actually the same thing as traits, so there's no concept of flattening, like treating all the things on the same level, and it's also static scope only. Particularly the static scope only thing is an issue that might bite you in the back at some point. So consider the following example. You have an interface locked that defines a can open function and static class door extension that provides an extension function for set locked thing. So far that looks quite promising. That even fits together quite well because it has this can open over here and this can open over here, which talks about the same things. However, you have this is meant to be connected in static scope and not in dynamic scope, which means that the implementation from here cannot really override the implementation that is over here. And well, you might wonder, there is no implementation. This is actually mapping to, it's an abstract abstract definition. There is no implementation given here. But since the dispatching is done in a static way, this is running into an actual compile time error since, well, the extension method cannot override the abstract signature. So, yeah, that's that. This has led to a further development, the so-called virtual extension method. These are things that came into play in Java 8. So, and I think, I'm not so sure, maybe you're more informed than me, I think in the newer standards of C#, at least in the coming one, there's a little bit of discussion around introducing virtual extension methods also to C#, I think, but same for me, but I think there's discussion about that, so don't discard that yet, but the working approach you see in Java 8, for example, there is the situation that you've seen in the problematic parts of the code a little bit earlier. There's the interface door that has can open and can pass as abstract definitions in there. There's the interfaces locked and short, which both provide implementations, can open and can pass. And you see that in this syntax, you don't actually need this special flagging of the receiver. Instead, you just provide a new version of the can open, and when you add everything together in your implements clause, what is actually done is all of them are treated as same level interfaces in that sense. So what is done is the symmetric join. So the value for can open from here is symmetrically joined with the value from can open from over here. And symmetric join says that abstract is overridden by a concrete implementation. So this is the one that is actually chosen. Same goes, of course, for the can pass from here and the can pass from here. So this is how everything is joined up into this short locked door. So there's a particular solution that keeps this notion of treating all of the of the modules with the same priority, which is this symmetric join, at least as long as you keep the joining in one implementation clause. As soon as you start having multiple of them, the whole thing falls apart pretty soon, since what you get over here is if you happen to have an abstract method which does not provide implementations for a particular method signature, but already has it defined as being abstract, just implementing another interface with a virtual method won't override this. So on the level of composing your interfaces to the classes, you still get a similar situation where the classes implementation overrides the implementation coming from the interface, even though it is still an abstract implementation in the class. So there's a certain disproportion between those two. So, yeah, but that is what these virtual extension methods are. So, none of them are real, well, in a sense, pure implementations of systems that have traits as general composition mechanisms, but kind of go already steps in the direction of traits. So, the actual idea behind the traits would be to really go in a system that focuses on traits as the general and only mechanism for composing software and modules, and this would mean that you would have this classical separation of creating hierarchical relations between interfaces, compose functionality with traits, and then glue it all together when you create classes from the traits and the interfaces. And this should create something like a simplified multiple inheritance without the adverse effects. So is there actually languages who provide something like that, like the Ruby for mixins? Well, turns out there is. Everyone probably has heard of Squeak. I guess so. I didn't either. So this is a particular dialect of Smalltalk in which the trait thing was implemented to its full extent. I don't know how familiar you are with Smalltalk syntax in particular, and you have like 5 minutes to go, so it's probably a little bit futile to actually really try to learn Smalltalk in that time. So that is how a Smalltalk program looks like. So you see, you might not be directly able to immediately understand every notion of that. And I don't even expect you to do so. For our purposes, it suffices to see that there is the keyword of trait that can be used in this context. So you can create things like traits, and you have expressions on already defined traits. So there's this trait stream and trait synchronized over here, and you can compose them by means of the operators that we have talked about. So there is the trait sum, there is the aliasing, and this is actually implemented in these systems. So there are a few out there, but since they require you to completely relearn syntax, I don't expect you to really. Scala traits. This is Scala traits are once again a good example for what I have told you before. Names in one language are not what they seem in other languages. So I think on the tutorial sheet has in the past has been an exercise on that. I don't know whether it will make it to this year's sheet or not. It's a little bit ambiguous. They talk about traits on there, but what they actually do is they require a certain linearization of the traits in there. And this is exactly not what the traits were actually all about. They were to be composed in parallel and to be treated as equals and without any priorities. And I think the realization of traits in Scala is actually, in the end, creating a hierarchy, which is more like the mix-in approach. And I think also the keyword mix-in is at some point used in there. So, yeah, missed it by a few centimeters, but still missed it. But I can understand the comment. Isn't there a language that provides it? Because it's called the same, but it's not actually the approach that you see over here. So I don't know. I think I would still call it a mix-in from a theoretical point of view in terms of talking about the expressivity that you can make out of that. But, well, in the long run, this notion might somehow at some point overshadow the theoretical traits so much that people will assume traits to be the things that you find in Scala. I don't know. But yeah, this is very typical for programming languages. What you see in one language under the name might be completely different in the other language. But yeah, there is a thing in there, but I explicitly didn't put it on there because it's actually quite confusing. Okay. Good. So, yeah, in order to disambiguate them from each other, traits and mixins are actually conceptually different things. The mixins can be considered to be these second order type operations, and linearizing the dispatching process. So you first look in one mixin, then go to next, and then to next. And the traits, by comparison, are these things that are